There have been and are different views on this, but even these past, this is important here now, even these past evangelicals who were theistic evolutionists affirmed the historicity of Adam and Eve and their fall. Those beliefs were non-negotiable. In contrast, most modern theistic evolutionists almost universally deny those older doctrines.
Could you explain what is pre-Adamite? What does that mean?
Some would refer to them as hominids or hominoids that were not fully, there are a couple of ways of looking at that. One is that they were not fully human beings, or they were not crowned as Adam and Eve. In other words, there were some pre-Adamites that existed that God then, or that from that group, one of two different ways, that from that group became the Adamites. In other words, that became the historical Adam and Eve. That is to say that they're pre-Adamites, but they weren't human created in the image of God. Adam and Eve from that group are the first that were created in the image of God. These pre-ones were not. Now, I'm not saying that's my position. You asked me to explain it. I'm trying to explain it to you. The other would be that there are these hominids, and from this group of hominids, God chooses or crowns two, Adam and Eve, and names them as the head of the human race. That would be another way of attempting to describe that. To some, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So all that to say, that would be a way in which they would try to describe that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's where we are. Now, what are some of the EFCA essentials? Where would we end up? Here's what we say. The EFCA states clearly and explicitly in our statement of faith, Article 1, that God is the creator of all things. We have spelled out some parameters in the EFCA on the matter of creation in Evangelical Convictions, a book that is out there on the table, a theological exposition of the statement of faith of the Evangelical Free Church of America. Notice on page 34, this is what we say in the book. To be sure, Genesis 1 expresses truth about God as creator and his creation, but because of the uncertainty regarding the meaning and literary form of this text and the lack of evangelical consensus on this issue, our statement does not require a particular position on the mechanics of creation. What we've attempted to do here is to state some essentials with some liberty. Okay? However, to be within the doctrinal parameters of the EFCA, any understanding of the process of creation must affirm. And there are these six things that must be affirmed. Number one, that God is the creator of all things out of nothing. God is the creator of all things out of nothing. Two, that he pronounced his creation very good. Genesis 1:31. We had read this. So everything that he created was very good. Very good. Third, that God created with order and purpose. The reason we're saying this is that this good creation is purposeful. It's not random. It's not chaotic. From the beginning, it's purposeful. God created with an end in mind and a means all the way. I mean, this is what we're stating. Four, that God is the sovereign ruler over all creation, which by his personal and particular providence, he sustains. Now, this is pretty significant because it speaks against deism. Deism said that God creates and then he steps back. He steps back. He made the clock. He made the watch. And now the watch just runs. And he doesn't give a rip about what happens. That's deism. That was pretty popular in the 19th century, and it still exists today. But that's the notion. We're denying that. Not only that, but we had to say this because, in a sense, we're also talking about a certain Socinian view that we would refute or that we would deny. So God, there's a place for miracles. Why? Because He is personal and particularly providentially sustaining that which He created. It's a pretty significant statement. Notice footnote number 9. Here's what we've said to footnote number 9. We deny the notion that God is simply the creator of the universe, but is no longer active in it, as is espoused by deism. You know, there's something very interesting about this. To some degree, those that are particularly... Now, hear the whole thing I'm going to say, all right? Hear the whole thing I'm going to say. In some ways, theistic evolutionists would affirm that you know, God established it there, but He's ongoingly, set it up such that it continues to mature and grow and whatever. And sometimes those that would affirm that it was all there then and there, that God created then and there, it's almost can fall to a notion of deism such that He couldn't tweak something. He couldn't come and plan something from time in eternity. But it's almost like He has stepped back. He did everything then and there, and now it's done. Now, He could have done that. But one needs to be careful in doing that you don't end up in a deistic sort of understanding.
Francis Collins almost pushes towards that to say, oh, He had to step in at a particular point. It was an incomplete work of His to begin with. And he really pushes hard against theistic evolution. Because
he doesn't push hard against it, he pushes for it.
Intelligent design, I'm sorry.
Yes, he is, just so we get things straight for everybody. Francis Collins affirms theistic evolution.
But not intelligent design.
He's opposed to the notion of intelligent design. We haven't even talked about intelligent design. That's intended to be almost pre-evangelism, but it's a powerful argument of design. It's an argument from design. But this is what we say. Back then to number five, that God created the first human beings. Again, this is pretty important. The historical Adam and Eve uniquely in His image. And six, and that through their sin, all humanity along with this created order is now fallen as articulated in our Article 3. And footnote 10, this statement does not speak to the precise process of creation or to the age of the universe to be acceptable within the EFCA. Any views on these specifics must completely affirm this statement of faith and align within these essential parameters. So this is what we've attempted to spell out. Now, we also have addressed this in Article 3 of the statement of faith. And here it comes, same book, Evangelical Convictions, Article 3, The Significance of Adam and Eve, pages 76, 77. Here's what we write. There are legitimate differences of opinion about how one understands the nature of the language used in the early chapters of Genesis to describe the actions of God in the world. However, our statement affirms that Adam and Eve were historical figures. Again, very important. They are historical figures. Footnote 16. Right here. The historical reality of Adam and Eve has been the traditional position of the church. So Tertullian, Athanasius, Augustine, Calvin, and is supported elsewhere in Scripture. Particularly, Paul compares the one man Adam with both Moses and Jesus, texts that we looked at. In addition, Luke traces the genealogy of Jesus back to Adam. We also looked at those two texts. Our statement affirms that Adam and Eve were historical figures in the following sense. Number one, from these two, all other human beings are descended. Remember we read Acts 17:26? Well, that's the proof text. Two, these two were the first creatures created in God's image such that they were accountable to God as responsible moral agents. That is to say, they were created in God's image. Differently than the rest of creation. There's no indication, well, there is an indication. Animals are not in the image of God. Animals and other created creatures do not appear in the same way. In fact, they're not accountable to God as responsible moral agents like we are because of the image. And third, these two rebelled against God, affecting all their progeny. Now you're talking about total inability. This is not Pelagianism. And then footnote 18. We said this. I'm sorry, is it 7? Did I miss 17? I guess I missed 17. We don't need to read that one yet, but it's a different issue. Important, but nonetheless. Consequently, no human beings existed prior to these two, and consequently, no human beings were sinless and without the need of a Savior. That's the important statement. Now notice this as well. What is essential, and this I made an argument earlier, what is essential to the biblical storyline is that the problem with the world is not ontological. That is our being. This gets back to the notion of original sin as opposed to sin of origin. And I'll come back to that. That is, it is not a result of the material nature of creation itself, nor is sin an essential part of our humanity. The problem is moral. The first human beings from the very beginning, in a distinct act of rebellion, chose to turn away from God, and this act not only affected all humanity, but creation itself. It's why creation groans to this day, longing to be liberated. This leads us from considering the dignity of humanity to acknowledging our depravity. And that's then what we do in the book, and in the statement of faith, we move on to the next. But as I ended that, this also gives us hope that human beings can be redeemed from sin. The questions, and here's what I find very interesting. Mark Knoll, he's a historian, and his statement regarding some of these issues, he looks to the past and learns after the fact. That's the bird's eye view that he likes to have. And he, as a historian, he does. Historians do historical research. They're not writing today's news. They're writing last year's news, and trying to figure out how do we understand it. But all that to say, he writes after, he looks to the past and learns after the fact and uses that to speak into the present or the future. He made that statement directly, addressing the issue of science and faith. And how do we understand these things? And he's saying, I just think, you know, I'm a historian, is what he said. Well, my response to that is, we as pastors and theologians and leaders in the church, we don't have that vantage point. We don't have that privilege. We don't have that ability to wait till tomorrow to respond to a fire or an emergency today. We just don't. Now, I want to be very careful that we don't respond haphazardly, that we don't respond rashly, we don't respond irrationally or irrationally, but respond we must. And so here's my statement to that. However, the pastor theologian does not have that liberty. The theologian needs to understand it and speak to it as a servant of the church. The pastor theologian must speak, and not to speak would be unfaithfulness. It is necessary to be careful about what is spoken, but speak, the pastor theologian must. The pastor theologian then needs to provide guidance in and during the discussion. The pastor theologian needs to work hard at making sure the issue is understood and framed well so it can be understood and discussed among God's people. For the pastor theologian to wait and be silent until after the fact would mean the pastor theologian too would be unfaithful to the calling as one called to serve God's people. That, by the way, is from an email that I sent to somebody talking about Mark Knoll's statement and my reply to that effect or to that degree. Do you agree with that? So some of the questions that we think through. How much have you known about this discussion? How do you keep up on these kinds of issues, and how do you address them from the pulpit and your teaching? You see, the thing that I think we want to avoid is that now we all of a sudden do a 100-week series on this issue. You know, it's kind of what we learned early in the survey from Ed Stetzer. Some are talking about it too much. Some are talking about it not enough. And And you know, rather than making this a series, though it might be worthwhile to make it a series, but I would say be wise and sensitive to include these sorts of things in certain applications or illustrations of your sermons or in your teaching. Talk about these kinds of things. Not to replace the text, of course, but to illustrate and apply how this is being, how it needs to be discussed, thought about, affirmed, denied, in amongst our people today. And again, that is one of the things that I do with our young people. We talk about these things. They come with their questions. It's very encouraging. It's a place where they can ask them. Secondly, how do you approach the question of faith and science? How is this discussion fruitfully engaged? Do you have both good and or bad examples? I've got one that was absolutely terrible. And well, I won't even tell you who they are. It was public, so I could, but I'm not going to. It was a perfect, wonderful example of what not to do. Oh, it was painful. It was painful. It polarized. It caricatured. It just was not helpful at all. And I think if you want to try this discussion with the elders or with others, let me know, and I can provide you the resources so you can read the exchanges between these people to find out what not to do. Honestly, it would be helpful to read that too, because it just wasn't helpful. It really wasn't helpful. But see, here's the thing. We are often concerned or threatened by the fact that if we are kind or humble or gracious with somebody, that we can't disagree with them. No. I can be kind and humble and gracious and still disagree strongly. But we often don't do that. Let me say one other thing. I think that generally, when we've engaged in apologetics over the years, my generation and older, we've engaged in apologetics as inductive and deductive. That's kind of been the way in which we have engaged in apologetics. The relationship has been secondary. The relationship with the person with whom we're communicating has been secondary. I'm speaking generally here, all right? I would say that the younger people, my children's age, generation, they generally lead with relationship. Relationship is pretty significant. Authenticity, integrity, etc. Pretty significant. And so when they hear someone leading so strongly, inductively, deductively, and dogmatically, they immediately draw certain conclusions. Some right, some wrong. Some may be right, some may be wrong. So what I'm saying is I think that we need to be, it doesn't mean that we compromise inductive, deductive, dogmatics, apologetics. It doesn't mean we compromise that at all. It means that we're sensitive to the culture, we're sensitive to the people, and we maybe approach it slightly differently. That is, we approach it relationally. And in fact, Alistair McGrath, in his book on apologetics, refers to this as abduction. Abduction is winning a hearing. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have to compromise at all, but I think that's sometimes the fear. The fear is if we move in that direction, you don't even care about truth. No, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what Alistair McGrath says at all. And so as we engage in this, old or younger, we need each other. So the younger need help to figure out that there is such a thing as apologetics. There is such a thing as black and white. There is such a thing as induction and deduction. There is such a thing as truth. I'm overstating the case. But all that to say, older people need to realize, you know what? Relationships do matter.
William Lane Craig, I think it was a wonderful attitude. Mm-hmm. This gracious spirit of winning debates without rubbing.
Yeah. You know, what is not helpful at all for the gospel of Jesus Christ is to win the argument and lose the relationship. Now, if the relationship is lost because the debate was lost, that's a different thing. Then there wasn't much of a relationship there anyway. But on the other hand, I just think it's something for us to consider. I think it's something for us to consider. How do you determine essentials and non-essentials in this discussion? Fourth, how are you helping people to understand and preparing them to engage these issues without narrowing too much or without broadening too wide? Wow. Okay, session two. I think we just wait. Thank you.
Greg, we'll give you 5 minutes to get through that packet if you want. But we'd hang on for that long. Okay, credentialing workshop starting pretty soon here. Okay, so for those of you who are not part of the credentialing workshop, if you could exit this room pretty quickly so we could get going, that would be great. Secondly, pay attention now. There's a Gander Mountain close by. For those of you who want to go and worship at a different altar. And if you're from New York, get your ammo now. While you're in Pennsylvania, because you can't get it in New York. Okay, all kidding aside, tomorrow morning, we start right back here. And I know it says 8:30, but we need to give Greg a little more time. So we're starting at 8:29.
Ha ha! Woohoo!
Okay. 8:29, be right here, ready to roll. Have a great evening.